Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. Roger Stone with us. Roger and I are going to talk, and then at a certain point, we'll take some questions from you. I apologize for the voice. As you may know, I was out today, which is very difficult. They had to come and take me out of the station. One of the great parts of this job is I've had Roger Stone on a dozen times over the years, but never had a chance to sit in person with him one-on-one as we did down below. And I feel like throwing out the 25 carefully prepared questions I had and let him talk for an hour. But at a certain point, we may see the tattoo that Roger Stone has. I'm sure you're all aware of that. So, Roger, you promised that at a certain point in the show tonight, right?
Well, I teased it. I'm not sure I promised.
And it's part of the Mount Rushmore of conservatives, his choice for that. So Roger's new book is exciting because, as you may know, Roger has been involved in all kinds of levels with Donald Trump. And as we've gone through this last campaign, out of all the years I've done talk radio, there's never been a phenomenon. There's never been a day like this. Roger's going to be on the Today Show tomorrow because this book is overwhelming, right? Or is there another reason?
Well, so some of you may know, I picked up yesterday's New York, actually this morning's New York Times, to read a story which had really been completely recycled from January 20th, Inauguration Day, only to read that I am a Russian agent and that I am under federal investigation for colluding with the Russian state to steal the election for Donald Trump. There's only one problem with this narrative. I don't know any Russians. I don't have any Russian clients. I don't have any Russian contacts. I don't have any Russian business. I have never been to Russia. I don't think I've ever spoken to any Russians, although a guy who was a friend of mine in college married a Russian woman briefly, and then she left him. I did meet her. This is a canard. This is the deep state, meaning the intelligence services, those at the Pentagon, the neocons, the two-party duopoly that have run this country into the ground. And they can't get over the election of Donald Trump because working together, the Bushes and the Clintons and Obama have given us endless war, erosion of our civil liberties, massive debt and spending and borrowing, an immigration system that leaves our neighborhoods and streets unsafe, trade policies that have, as Ross Perot correctly predicted, sucked the jobs out of America. And you have to wonder about our foreign policy, unless, of course, it is our goal to strengthen and empower our enemies and undercut our allies, because that's what it seems to me we have been doing. And the two-party duopoly has worked together to foster these policies. Look, I'm a Republican. I have a great sentimental attachment to the Republican Party of Barry Goldwater, the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. But that is far different than the Republican Party of George H.W. Bush and his son. I'm not the greatest fan of John McCain. But when he said, accusing George W. Bush of spending like a drunken sailor, it was an insult to drunken sailors. The spending when we had a Republican president and two houses of Congress was beyond anything the Democrats ever thought of. So the Republican Party in recent years, we talk a good game about smaller government. We talk a good game about cutting regulation and taxes. But in the end, it doesn't happen. And the reason I think it doesn't happen is because our system operates on the basis of special interest money. And at the end of the day, everybody who's been elected to public office is beholden to the donors. And the donors are special interests. To me, this is Donald Trump's single greatest selling point. As a billionaire, nobody can buy Donald Trump. He's not for sale. He doesn't need your money. And if it has strings attached to it, he doesn't want your money. He's his own man. You can't buy him. You can't bully him. This is why I think you may have, in Trump, the first president actually capable of cutting federal spending. Because you see, everything that's in the federal budget, and I worked on both sides of the Congress. I was a legislative assistant to Senator Bob Dole, who I saw last night. I took his wife to dinner for Valentine's Day, 94 years old. The guy is amazing, sharp as a tack. And I worked on the House side for Congressman Robert Steele, who was on the budget committee. Every dollar that's in the federal budget, well, even wasteful dollars and fraudulent dollars, they're put there by somebody. And somebody, whether it's a senator or a congressman at the behest of a special interest or a lobbyist, they will fight to keep it there. Donald Trump will be impervious to all of that. And I think we may finally have a president who will cut the size of the federal government.
Let me take you back to what you said about the Republican Party of today. Grossest example, and I think people in the room are spoiling to go to a town hall with some of these Republicans, is Obamacare. 7 years, repeal it. They made all those moves. They don't seem to be anywhere near any kind of political savvy and gumption to repeal and replace Obamacare. What do you think?
Yeah, it's deeply concerning. The president, I think, was forthright about this in the campaign, and he hasn't flinched. He doesn't want to leave people in the cold. He doesn't want to leave people in the lurch. So he has to go from the old system to the new system seamlessly. It just seems to me that as the party of ideas, we should be able to come up with a more market-based approach to solve this problem. In a country this wealthy, nobody should go without health care. And as Donald Trump said in the campaign over and over again, perhaps distinguishing himself from other people, I'm not throwing people in the snow. I'm not taking people who are ill or indigent and not able to help themselves and just cutting them out of the system. I mean, that's the old Republican Party of Ebenezer Scrooge, the root canal party, the, you know, it's got to hurt to be good for you Republican Party, as opposed to the optimistic, pro-growth Republican Party of a Jack Kemp or a Ronald Reagan or a Donald Trump. So, I have said now for a couple days on the circuit as I promote this book, I think Donald Trump's biggest problem is not the liberal Democrats. It's the establishment Republicans who like things just the way they are, who like the status quo, who like getting reelected, who like groveling for PAC money every night. And they're not prepared to do anything radical when the American people are demanding a radical change. When the American people are demanding that somebody do something to halt the decline of this country.
Let's talk about the word chaos. I don't know in your book, and I read it thoroughly, Roger, that you say that, but Donald Trump seems to embody that, like that. And the media now seems to say what's going on the first 4 weeks is chaotic in a negative sense. Is that hype? Does Trump really like to create all these competing factions and chaos in his business and now as president?
I think that's an overstatement. Here's what I think is really happening. First of all, Donald Trump prides himself on being accessible. In building his business empire, it didn't matter whether you were a tile layer or an electrician or a job foreman or one of his vice presidents. You could always get in to see the boss if you had a complaint or a better idea of how something could be done. He prides himself on his accessibility. I've seen this firsthand. This is a guy who can use the phone like Lyndon Johnson. And watching him jawbone these Fortune 500 executives to stay in this country, to come to this country, to expand, to hire here, create jobs here, expand here, you've just seen the beginning. Because sure, it's 1,000 jobs here and 1,000 jobs there, but it's symbolic of the fact that we have a president who cares and who will try, and that every job is important, every single job. I do think that he has a tendency to pit advisors against each other, something Franklin Roosevelt was very successful at, because he wants to get the best from everybody, Because he knows at the end of the day, unlike many other politicians I have worked for, nobody puts words in his mouth. Nobody puts ideas in his head. Nobody decides what he's going to do.
Wait a minute. That's the meme that's out there. Whoever whispers in his ear, Ivanka's in this ear, Roger Stone's in this ear, they're giving competing advice, whoever says it last. Not so?
No. I think that, I hate to use an expression from George W. Bush, but Trump is the decider. Sure, he'll always listen. He's always willing to listen. But at the end of the day, you cannot put words in his mouth. I know. I've tried, and I've failed. It won't work. He's not a conventional politician. He's just not built that way. You know how much preparation he did for those debates? I can tell you. Because he knew what he was going to say before he got there. Because he understood this is a performance. This is about big picture. It's not about wonkishness. It's not about throwing out statistics and figures and showing that you understand the underpinnings of the federal government. If that's what we wanted, we would have elected Newt Gingrich president. The only problem with that is the Andy Warhol Foundation wanted their wig back.
Well, let's take some shots at other prominent Republicans. You spend maybe an excessive amount of time in a book on Trump going after Ted Cruz. Why?
Yeah, I am not a fan of Ted Cruz. You know why people take an instantaneous dislike to Ted Cruz? They are merely saving time. Every member of the U.S. Senate gets to the Senate and looks around and says, well, hell, I'm the smartest guy here. But Ted Cruz got to the U.S. Senate and he said, hell, I'm the only smart guy here. He is a Bush Republican, a country club Republican. He's responsible for most of the policies of the George W. Bush administration. He was George W.'s brain. And he went to Texas and he reinvented himself as a constitutional conservative. What kind of constitutional service takes $1 million secret loan from Goldman Sachs and another $1 million secret loan from Citibank, doesn't report him as required by law in his Senate campaign filings, and then claims to be a great critic of Wall Street? He is without friends in the U.S. Senate. He is without friends in Washington. Politics does have a likability factor. This is what was Ronald Reagan's great secret. He was underestimated, and he was imminently likable. You couldn't meet him and not like him. The truth is, Donald Trump, in person, is very much the same way. In other words, he's a regular guy. He can talk to anybody. Cab driver, waitress, stevedore, Fortune 500 executive, it doesn't matter. He moves easily in every strata of society. He's got an easy banter with people, and he can get people to talk to him. He likes a good cheeseburger. This is not a guy going out to the fanciest restaurants in Manhattan. He's a homebody. Before he was in politics, on weeknights, he was home with his family watching television or playing with his grandchildren. This is not a guy who was out on the party circuit with his friends. He's a regular guy. He has a wicked sense of humor. He is fun to hang out with. He doesn't drink. Not a drop. He's never had a drop of alcohol in his life. He disdains drinking. He disdains smoking. And obviously, he disdains drugs. At the same time, he's not a prig. He's not preaching to you. Mm-hmm. He understands that you have to run your life, and he runs his. So he working for Donald Trump is an enormous amount of fun. I mean, I loved Richard Nixon. I worked for him in two elections. But hanging out with Nixon was not fun.
But let's talk about Nixon. Was it 88? And how long has Trump been thinking about running for president? And you even had Richard Nixon conversation with him about you saw Trump as a potential president way back when.
Yeah, the first person that I know, and this includes me, who could see the potential for a Trump candidacy for president was Richard Nixon. In 1987, they were both invited by George Steinbrenner, the owner of the New York Yankees, to attend a game in the Steinbrenner box, in the owner's box, and they met for the first time. I was working for former President Nixon, just doing political chores, And I also had the Trump Organization as a client. I had met Donald Trump during the 1980 Reagan campaign. And after President Reagan's election, I had been retained by Donald to work for a couple of his companies solving various governmental problems they had. Anyway, the two men met, and the next day, Nixon called me, and he said, "Well, I met your man, and let me tell you, he's got it. He's really got it. This guy could go all the way." Now, that's praise from Caesar. Nixon was hypercritical when looking at the political talent of others. And about 2 days later, he sent Donald Trump a letter, which I reproduce in the book, in which, and this is very typical of Nixon's circumlocution, he writes, "Dear Donald, Mrs. Nixon saw you on the Mike Douglas show, and she was very impressed. Mrs. Nixon says that if you ever run for political office, you will win, and you should run because you could go all the way. And Mrs. Nixon," he says, "knows about these things." Well, let's face it, it was Richard Nixon who watched him on the Mike Douglas show and who thought that he could go all the way. About a month after that, I made arrangements for Donald Trump and former President Nixon to go to Houston, Texas for a weekend where they were both stars at a charity event. And they spent the entire weekend locked together in a hotel suite. And Nixon told me Trump just fired questions at me, one after another. The Chinese, the Russians, right. Eisenhower. He said it was a geographic around-the-world tour. And Nixon came away even more impressed with Trump's intellect and Trump's intensity. So he was the first person to see a Trump president.
All right, that's worth the price of admission in the book, Nixon and Trump in a hotel room for a weekend. That is just mind-boggling stuff. Do you talk in the book, Trump vis-a-vis Ronald Reagan? I know how you feel about Reagan. You were there as this was going on. You mentioned him a moment ago. Do you see any element there? Likeability, I guess, would be the factor.
Well, I'd say two things. I met Donald Trump trying to recruit him for Ronald Reagan's campaign. In 1979... I was sent to New York to organize what was considered a hostile state to try to win delegates for the nomination of Ronald Reagan and then later try to win the general election. If you go back and look at it, by the way, Reagan carried New York State in a three-way race in which the local Liberal Party endorsed John Anderson for president, and therefore the general election in that state was a three-way race. And Reagan won with 48%, 46% of the vote, I believe. In any event, they gave me a card file, like a recipe box, and it had about 40 index cards in it. And Mike Deaver, who was Governor Reagan's chief traveling aide, gave me this box and said, "This is a list of the Reagan's friends in New York. Maybe you can recruit some of them for the campaign." So I went through the cards. There were about 40 cards. And I'm not exaggerating when I tell you 30 out of the 40 people were dead. They were all theatrically connected. In other words, they were connected to Broadway and to entertainment. None of them were political. But there was a card for the lawyer, Roy Cohn. Infamous, flamboyant, extremely controversial. But he had known Ronald and Nancy Reagan since the 50s when Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild and Roy was working for Joe McCarthy fighting communists. So I made an appointment. I called Cohn's office. I told them who I was. I made an appointment. And they said, "Well, he can squeeze you in Thursday morning. Come by. Your meeting's at 11 o'clock. So I went to his office. It was a brownstone on the Upper East Side. And they had me wait for, I don't know, 45 minutes. And finally, the receptionist said, "Mr. Cohn, we'll see you now. Go up to the second floor." And he's in the dining room. So I walked into the dining room, and Roy Cohn was sitting there. He was wearing a silk robe. He looks like he had just gotten out of bed. His eyes were so red, it was obvious he'd been out all night. And sitting with him was a corpulent gentleman. And he said, "Mr. Stone, I want you to meet Tony Salerno, also known as Fat Tony Salerno, the boss of the Genovese family in New York, and a client of Roy's." Roy represented a number of men who were accused of being in organized crime, but who were no doubt just legitimate businessmen.
Albeit corpulent.
In any event, Salerno says to you, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Stone. Roy here says this time we're going with Regan." So I knew I had a sale. Roy finally dismissed the mob boss. He left. And I made my pitch as to how Reagan could win and what I needed in New York State. I need a headquarters. I need telephones. I need volunteers. I need a finance committee. And when I said that, Roy said, "You need Donald Trump. You need Donald and Fred Trump." Fred Trump was a personal friend of Barry Goldwater's, had been a major financier of Goldwater's campaign, and they would be ideal. "Do you know Donald Trump?" he said. "No, of course not. I only know his name from the tabloids." He said, "Well, I'll make you an appointment, but I'm going to warn you right now. He's going to give you 10 minutes. Get in, get out. Make your pitch. He's very, very busy, and he's going to squeeze you in, so don't waste his time." So I went to meet him the very next day, and I was immediately taken by his size. I don't mean his physical size, although he's tall and broad-shouldered, but there was a magnetism, an electricity, an attraction that goes beyond charisma. It's very hard to describe. It's like a command presence. I was very impressed. I said, "Mr. Trump, it's a great pleasure to meet you." And he said, "Please call me Donald." And I have since that time. The day after he became president, I called him and said, "Well, congratulations, Mr. President." And he said, "Please call me Donald." It's the kind of man he is. He is self-effacing. He specializes in self-deprecating humor. If you spent time with him, you would know that. And he was immediately, I think, someone who had a political future. He also had no interest in ever running for political office, and he made that pretty clear. But I go back to an interview that he gave to Oprah Winfrey almost 30 years ago when she said to him, "Donald, can you ever see yourself running for public office? Would you ever run for president?" And he said, "No, I don't think so, unless things get so bad that I have no choice." That's where we are, folks. And that's why he is the president of the United States.
Okay, we have some questions for Roger from the audience. And there's a whole array of people that you know better than I. I've only interviewed them. But Rance Priebus, should he stay or should he go? Is he not President Trump's conduit to the establishment? How's Rance Priebus doing?
Well, I think if you want to keep faith with the people who elected you, and if you want to pursue a very specific and detailed agenda of revitalizing the economy, sealing our borders, building the wall, renegotiating the big international trade agreements, trying to reassert a foreign policy that has some common sense, rebuilding our military strength, supporting our law enforcement, then you should surround yourself with people who share that vision, people whose loyalty is to you, not the Republican Party. I'm sure Reince Priebus is a perfectly nice guy. I met him once. I said, "Hey, Reince, that's a good-looking suit. Do you think they make it in a man's size?" No, I've had it up to here with Reince Priebus, I'm going to tell you. Look, I think that the leaking at the White House is disgraceful. When somebody gives you a job, you owe them your loyalty. I understand strategic leaking. There are times when the president might direct a leak, for strategic reasons. But when you're leaking, it makes the boss look bad. When a White House employee says the president is like a clueless child, the Washington Post, or the president wears a shabby bathrobe and watches TV in the family quarters, well, it's pretty drafty, I can tell you that. Then you're disserving the person who gave you the best job in your life. Those kind of leaks don't serve anybody. They're leaks to make the leaker feel important. They're leaks that the leaker uses to suck up to reporters, and they're disgraceful. I can tell you this, the leaks in the White House are not coming from Kelly Conway, are not coming from Stephen Miller, are not coming from Steve Bannon and the Trump loyalists. They're coming from those whose loyalty is to the Republican National Committee and not the president. And I think it is disgraceful. Leaks about whether the president's executive order on immigration could have been handled better, second-guessing your own colleagues, this is helping no one. I do believe that Mr. Priebus was instrumental in helping push General Flynn out the door. It is very clear to me, now that we look at it, General Flynn didn't break any laws. The people who leaked the fact that he had these conversations, they broke the law. It's very rare that the U.S. government ever admits that they are eavesdropping on a U.S. citizen, particularly a government official, and the disclosure of that violates Section 18, subsection 739 of the U.S. Code. Somebody should go to jail. It's punishable by 10 years in jail.
Let's back up 1 second there, Roger, though. Okay, why then, unless you don't believe it, did he mislead or lie to Mike Pence then? What was Flynn's position in doing that if he didn't do anything that was wrong? Why do that?
It's a question I cannot answer. If he did anything wrong, it was misleading the vice president. Right. And therefore, he could have solved this problem by apologizing to the president, by apologizing to the American people, and he could have gone about his job. I think he was an important part of the team there. But there are those in the permanent establishment who realize that he is among those who connects radical Islam with terrorism. That's a no-no in Washington. We're supposed to pretend they have no connection. The CIA director, John Brennan, who is the source of those leaks in the New York Times, a man who refused to be sworn on a Bible when he became CIA director, a man who I say converted to Wahhabism when he was the station chief for the CIA in Ridda, in Saudi, a man who insists that there are no links between Islamic fundamentalism and terrorism, a man who was active in the U.S. Communist Party. Look it up. It's in his wiki biography. That was Barack Obama's CIA director. How did this guy ever get confirmed by the U.S. Senate? Personally, I think he's a Saudi mole. And I've written about this extensively in this book and also at my website, The Stone Cold Truth. If you want to find out what's going on in politics and you want it unvarnished the way I try to do it, check out thestonecoldtruth.com.
Let's talk about some of the other players. In the green room, we talked a little bit about Sean Spicer, who surprises me how combative he is. I had him on 10, 15 times, listeners know, during the campaign. I thought he was kind of marshmallow, not aggressive at all. And now he's being billed as the best thing in daytime TV because of all this back and forth with the media.
You know, I don't think we need two Donald Trumps. Donald Trump is great when it comes to taking on the opposition, fake news, and so on. I think the job of the press secretary is actually to be more conciliatory, let the boss do the heavy lifting, because that is his style. I have been kind of tickled by the Saturday Night Live depiction of Sean Spicer. I only regret that Chris Farley is not still alive to play him.
Let's go to the guy I have no access to. I don't think too many people do. Steve Bannon. I can't imagine Stone and Bannon sitting together and what might come out of that. What are your thoughts on Bannon?
Well, I'm a Bannon fan because Steve Bannon shares the president's worldview. But the idea that he is Trump's brain, or that he is Trump's Rasputin or Svengali, and that he is putting ideas in the president's head, it's exactly the other way around. In other words, the two men became friends because they were copacetic in their worldview. They already had the same view on immigration, for example. So this idea that he is, you know, pulling the strings and that Donald Trump is some kind of marionette is just entirely false. I base that on 40 years of working for Donald Trump off and on. He is not a man who is susceptible to that kind of treatment. So Bannon is merely implementing what the president wants done, not the other way around. I wish he would be more aggressive in supporting Trump people in the personnel process. On the other hand, we're only 3 weeks into this administration, maybe a little longer, and hope springs eternal.
Mike Pence, thoughts on Pence? It seems to be a guy who is more than a vice president, seems to be the day-to-day sort of guy for Donald Trump. What are your thoughts on him?
Well, I'm a fan of Mike Pence. I think he was exactly the right running mate. In the end, I can tell you we came down to a choice between Governor Chris Christie, former Speaker Newt Gingrich, and Mike Pence. Those were the three finalists. Not to take anything away from the other gentlemen, but we would have been wallowing in the George Washington Bridge scandal in October if we had taken Chris Christie. I'm happy to say that he's now been cleared and that issue is gone. And I think his greatest public service still lies ahead of him. Newt Gingrich, to me, 280s to yesterday. I like him. He's been very good in terms of his campaign activities for the president, but I don't think he was the right guy. You needed someone who could reassure the party conservatives. You needed somebody who could reassure the evangelical Christian movement within the party and the Trump constituency. But you also needed somebody who wouldn't try to overshadow or contradict the president, somebody who understands that the vice presidency is a supporting role. It's not the lead role, it's a supporting role. Mike Pence has done his job with class and with dignity and with grace, and I think he's a great man. I'm very impressed, and that's not just because he asked me if I was interested in doing stunt double work.
One of the things we're most intrigued with, I know I am and listeners are, we've seen a breakthrough here in Philadelphia with big labor. There's a guy named Johnny Dock who's notorious, and he and I have been on together on the same page because of Trump and because of the breakthrough that Trump has engaged in with various union officials. But when I see Bannon talk about an infrastructure project of $1 trillion, I'm waiting to see something more creative in there that wouldn't be the usual nonsense that we've seen, say, with the Obama stimulus.
Well, Donald Trump is first and foremost a builder. This is what he knows best. And that's a good thing because our infrastructure has gone to hell. Our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our schools, our hospitals, our highways, our public facilities. I don't know how many of you have flown in or out of LaGuardia Airport in New York recently, but it really is like a third world airport. It's like stepping into 1959. It's disgraceful. It's dirty. It's non-functional. It's yesterday. So we need that. Where I agree with you, though, is I think we've got to look at more creative ways to finance this. There's got to be a way to rebuild our country, either by selling bonds or some other mechanism that won't leave us with enormous debt. It's always interesting. I love to see Andrew Cuomo announce all these grandiose problems to rebuild this and rebuild that. And then he mentions in the small print, by the way, we don't have the money for any of this. Great public relations, but nothing's getting built. So there are at least three initiatives I know for more creative financing of an infrastructure revival. Here, though, I think is the key point. And we talked earlier about the entire Russian question. First of all, I completely reject the idea that anyone, myself included, obviously, was colluding with the Russians, or that the Russians did anything to enhance the election of Donald Trump. In fact, just the opposite is true. Until fairly late, given their successful financial arrangements with the Clintons, I think they would have preferred Hillary Clinton. After all, she was happy to sell them control of our uranium as Secretary of State. At some point, I think they began to realize that she was not a sure thing and that Trump could win. The real issue here is a war and peace issue. It's about whether we should go to war over Syria. Now, Assad, who currently runs Syria, propped up by the Russians, finances Hezbollah, finances Hamas, finances Islamic terrorism. He's no friend of ours. On the other side, you have ISIS, propped up by the Saudis. Guess what? They're not friends of ours either. So why would we spend a drop of American blood or a borrowed American dollar? Because when we bombed Libya, we didn't have the cash. We had to go borrow the $1 billion, roughly, for bombs. Donald Trump favors detente. Donald Trump would rather try to sit down with Putin. He has no illusions. He knows Putin is a tough guy, a bad guy. He knows that they have a bad system, a totalitarian system. But he'd rather take a chance on peace and see if he can't hammer out some kind of agreement. If Brezhnev and Nixon can get together and limit strategic nuclear weapons, then Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin can get together and make a deal for peace. Very simply, Hillary Clinton promised the boys at Langley and the folks at the Pentagon the expansion of the proxy war in Syria. Let me say this. A no-fly zone over Syria enforced by the United States is an open invitation for World War III. And the American people voted for peace. So Donald Trump was not only the candidate of the silent majority, the candidate of the forgotten Americans, the candidate of law and order, but he was also the candidate of peace. And that's why the Central Intelligence Agency and the permanent government is trying so desperately to discredit him, because they like war. War is profitable for certain people. And you can justify your budgets at the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies because, God knows, we might be headed to a war.
Just got a text from a friend saying that CNN right now is saying that you were one of Trump's campaign people who were in touch with the Russians during the campaign. Just in. I'm not sure how big the panel was, probably as big as what we have here in the room tonight on CNN, but I know you've had, they won't put you on, there's been a back and forth. What do you say to that?
Well, as I said earlier, I categorically deny colluding with the Russians or even knowing any Russians or even being in touch with any Russians during this campaign or any prior campaign. I do have a big confession to make, though. I like Russian vodka. That's the extent of it. I've never been to Russia. I don't know anyone in Russia. If you went through my current list of contacts and my cell phone or my computer, you won't find any Russians. You also won't find any intermediate for the Russians. Doesn't exist. So this is a canard, continues to be promulgated by the New York Times, picked up by CNN, which, by the way, folks, is not a news organization. CNN is a propaganda front. They long ago stopped being a news organization. Before the election, they had John Podesta on in prime time, just before the election, and he claimed that I knew about the hacking of his email account by WikiLeaks in advance. After the election, he was on in prime time saying that I not only knew that the Russians were feeding WikiLeaks, but I gave Donald Trump advance notice. Both those things are lies, but a real news organization calls you up and says, here's what he says, please give us your response, and they play both of them. Mm-hmm. That's what journalists do. CNN is fake news.
Great audience here. Here's the question to that. Did you help finance WikiLeaks during the most recent elections? There you go. I don't know if CNN has somebody in the room here tonight.
I've been very forthright about this. It kind of tickles me. You see the headline, Stone admits tie to Assange. I didn't admit it. I announced it. I was on a radio show, and I told my audience exactly this. I have a mutual friend. A friend of mine is a friend of Julian Assange's. He's a journalist. No, I'm not going to tell you his name because I don't want him to be fired. He spoke to Assange, and then he spoke to me. And he told me WikiLeaks has the goods on Hillary. It's devastating information, and they're going to begin releasing it in early October. They did, and he did. Everything I said was true. That doesn't mean they told me the substance of the disclosures. That doesn't mean they told me the timing mm-hmm. of the disclosures, other than that it would be in October. So when I predicted on October 4th, that it was the beginning of the end for Hillary and that WikiLeaks would start unloading on her, it wasn't based on any direct knowledge. It was based on indirect knowledge. But to say that Stone knew everything and knew the Russians were feeding information to WikiLeaks, which I don't think is true, in which Assange has denied, that is false.
Question from the audience, Roger. At what point does the Democratic hissy fit become sedition? And let me add to that, my view is what's going on, and we talk about this a lot, is playing right into Donald Trump's hands. The more they do these outrageous things, the more the Burlington Coat Factory here in South Jersey drops Ivanka's lines, the more misery they try to create, the more people in the middle who are apolitical are going to side with Trump.
Yeah, I agree. I had a reporter from the New York Times call me yesterday and say that she had noted that Donald Trump had not returned to New York since the inauguration, that he has gone to Florida for two weekends, but then returned to Washington. And she said, is it because of the massive demonstrations that are planned when he comes here? And I said, well, I really hope they are massive because the politics of polarization is good for Donald Trump. Let the American people get a good look at these people. And they are only driving good people, middle-class people, people who don't demonstrate, who go to church, who go to work, who don't bitch and complain, who love their country, who salute the flag, who say their prayers. It just drives them into our camp. That's the difference. I think that the elitist rejection of Trump, the elitist derision of Trump, is only helping build a coalition of working people who are not elitist, who love their country, and who are fed up with what's happening to it.
Exactly right. So, with that being said, if Roger Stone could manipulate things, I think Democrats are playing right into our hands if Elizabeth Warren is the face of the Democrat Party. Did I emphasize face? You can't do any better than that. Maybe. Bernie Sanders, at least to me, is a guy that seems to be, as a communist, normal. Elizabeth Warren is from another planet.
Yeah, this is ironically a joke that the president can never quite get right. She claimed to be an Indian, a Native American, in order to get a preference at Harvard. That's why they call her Pocahontas, not Pocahontas.
Al Franken says that's racist, and anyone that laughed in the room is a racist.
Al Franken, let's face it. Al, I'm glad you went into politics because you were never funny. Never funny. And when Joe Piscopo becomes governor of New Jersey, then you'll get funny.
Let's turn back to your book, Roger. Talk a little bit about this, what you put together here, the Trump Revolution. Talk about what you put into each chapter. Talk about your grand plan in this. And take us through the book a little bit. We haven't done enough on that.
Sure. Well, some of you may be familiar with a very famous book called The Making of the President 1960, mm-hmm. which was written by Theodore H. White, Teddy White, who was a very famous journalist. And that book really changed the way politics was reported in this country. White took a combination of analysis of big picture trends in the country, the late Eisenhower years, the kind of growth of the suburbs after World War II, and so on, and he mixed it with some gritty stories from the campaign trail for a mesmerizing book. I got to meet him in 1976 when I was working for Governor Reagan. He invited me to his home for dinner in New York City. He was a very engaging guy. He asked tough questions. He too liked a good martini. And therefore, I wanted to use his style in the book, and that is what I have done. This is, in my opinion, the definitive insider's look of how Donald Trump pulled off the greatest upset in American political history. From an analytical point of view, I make the case in the book that this is the election in which the tipping point was finally reached and the mainstream media monopoly on the dissemination of political information was finally broken. By that I mean technological advances have dictated that now a majority of voters are getting their information on their handheld device. They're not getting it from a television set anymore. And that lends itself to more choices, because to get to CBS, you got to go through the internet. Mm-hmm. And when you go to the internet, you quickly realize that there's better stuff there than CBS or CNN or any of the mainstream media outlets. Now, I wrote a book on the Kennedy assassination called The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. It's a New York Times bestseller. I'm very proud of it. I'm not a lawyer, but if you read this book and you don't think Johnson did it, there's something wrong with you. In 1963, however, a government cover-up was easy. There were only three networks. There were only two national newspapers. If they said something happened, it happened. If they said something didn't happen, or if they didn't report it, it didn't happen. It was easy to control information flow to the people. Today, in the post-internet age, the American people have more choices. And therefore, if you don't like what you see at CNN, you can go to Breitbart. You can go to InfoWars. You can go to Town Hall. You can go to the Daily Caller. You can go to dozens of other outlets and get better investigative journalism, a more objective point of view. Donald Trump realized this long before anyone, and I think it partially explains his rise. The other thing that I think was crucial, that I go into in the book at great length, was the fact that the career politicians and the two parties did not realize the level of anger among the American people. They thought this was going to be just another election. Jeb Bush versus Hillary Clinton. Good God. After all, Jeb couldn't be stopped. Everyone knew he was a sure thing. Mitt Romney didn't run in 2016. He wanted to, but he concluded that Jeb was unstoppable. So much for his political antenna. This election was unlike any other because of this level of anger, this level of disillusionment. The American people were tired of career politicians, tired of both parties, tired of Congress, tired of political institutions, but here's the difference. For the first time ever, they finally figured out that the mainstream media is in bed with the establishment, and they are merely repeating the narrative of the established order, the narrative of the status quo. And therefore, they started looking elsewhere. In Donald Trump, you had somebody who entered the race universally known. Everybody knew who the Donald was when he showed up. He didn't have the intermediary step of explaining who he was and what he had done. Sure, we may know Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, but a majority of the American people had no idea who that was. Mm-hmm. So Trump could go right to ideas. He didn't have to educate people about what he had already accomplished or who he was. He also had the advantage of not needing to be president in order to be somebody, not needing to be president to be a success. He was already a notable success. He didn't need to be president for self-reaffirmation. He had already become a billionaire who was universally known around the globe as the most famous real estate developer and magnate perhaps on the face of the planet. So there was not the ambition to be president without knowing what you wanted to do when you got there. George H.W. Bush always wanted to be president, had no idea what his agenda would be. So in Trump, I think, the country saw a tough guy, above all, a guy you couldn't buy and you couldn't bullet, independent, and somebody who was bigger than the Republican Party. Let's face it, his nomination is the hostile takeover of the Republican Party. And we see that playing out in Washington even today. There's two other things here that are important and that I focus on. Donald Trump got 3% more of the African American vote than Mitt Romney. Now you can say, well, that's de minimis, that's not much. No, it isn't. But it did give us Michigan, it did give us Wisconsin, it did give us Pennsylvania, and it gave us the White House. That small incremental difference for two reasons. The African American vote was down overall, anywhere from 4 to 6%, largely based on the fact that the Clintons had pushed the 1994 crime bill. Now, if you're not familiar with the 1994 crime bill, I can tell you it has incarcerated an entire generation of young black men for the nonviolent crime of possession of small amounts of drugs. And here's the most interesting part. The mandatory penalties for possession of crack cocaine, rock cocaine, are far more harsh than the mandatory penalties for powdered cocaine. Yet they're the same substance. Who uses rock cocaine? Black people, minorities, poor people. Who uses powder cocaine? Rich white people. It's racist. It is racist. And this is why Hillary said black people need to be brought to heel. The only place the Clintons ever wanted to feed black people was in a prison cafeteria. And many, many black people figured this out, that they had played their dog whistle politics in Arkansas. By the way, Governor Bill Clinton went to federal court to argue that the Arkansas state troopers, among the worst in the country for abusing people, should be allowed to pull people over based on the color of their skin, which is just wrong. So the underperformance among African-American voters, which was accentuated by widespread education of black voters about Danny Williams. Who is Danny Williams? He is the abandoned, illegitimate son of Bill Clinton, who was banished by Hillary. And his story is told in the book. But more importantly, his story was told in a compelling documentary. A documentary that 38 million black people saw on Facebook. His second video was seen by 22 million people. And a comprehensive case was made that he was, in fact, the son of Bill Clinton, and he was abandoned by Hillary for political reasons. There are interviews with his mother and his aunt and his other aunt talking about how an Arkansas state trooper would come to their house at the beginning of every month with an envelope with $700 in it. It would talk about how Arkansas state troopers would deliver Christmas presents to the house where Danny lives. By the way, if you haven't seen Danny's picture, it's D-A-N-N-E-Y, Danny Williams, look him up. It's amazing. You know who he looks like? His daddy.
Talking about the new media, listeners should know, and I did not know this, that Roger Stone is an official member of the fraternity of talk radio hosts. So tell us about that. You're getting your feet wet in talk radio.
I have a show on Saturdays from 1 to 3. On the Genesis Communications Network called The Stone Cold Truth. As I told Dom beforehand, there's a big difference between being a guest and being a host, so I'm still learning the ropes. Additionally, I'm now doing, every Wednesday, I do from 3 to 4, I do 1 hour on Infowars.com as the host, and that is simulcast on 212 radio stations nationwide. So between those two experiences, I'm just trying to follow in Dom's footsteps and be a great radio host, because he is among the best. and I have a lot to learn, but it's enormous fun. Let me tell you one other thing. It's a huge amount of hard work. For a two-hour show, you need 3 hours of preparation because you can't wing it. You have to know what you're talking about, and you have to have a plan. So my hat's off to you. This is not easy, and to do it really well is really not easy, but I'm having a good time, and I invite you to tune in.
Let's talk about somebody I mentioned to Roger Stone backstage, and he is in alliance with them. I'm not sure as a mentor or kindred spirits because of how colorful Roger Stone has been over the years, how dynamic he is. Milo is this generation that has set things on fire, literally, in Berkeley. And first, have you done a lot of things on college campuses? If you went to a college campus now, would they come after you? Would you expect that? And your alliance with Milo and Alex Jones?
Milo's a very good friend. And now that I've seen what's happened on the college campuses when he went there, I'm going to consider going. I think controversy is good. It makes people think. And it allows you to attract public attention. We have a situation in which, with the advent of the internet and cable and talk radio, and of course the old mainstream media, viewers and consumers have thousands of choices. There's a glut of information. They're constantly being bombarded with choices and more information, whether it's infotainment like CNN or whether it's news like Breitbart. They're overwhelming choices. And therefore, I have learned, in order to get anybody's attention, yeah, you've got to be over the top. Yeah, you've got to be a little outrageous. Above all, you've got to be entertaining. Former President Nixon once said to me, the only thing worse in politics than being wrong is being boring. Well, Donald Trump is never boring.
Absolutely. So let's look into the future now. What should people come out here tonight? We're only 4 weeks in. What do you see Trump doing over the next few months that you think is being talked about now and is about ready to be released? What is the signature thing that you see coming up?
I think you're going to have more executive orders. I think he's going to do as much as he can under executive order. It's interesting to see all these liberals bitching about it because they thought it was fine and dandy when Barack Obama was doing it. So live by the sword, die by the sword. Then I think you're going to see a comprehensive legislative program. I would urge the president to focus first on the economy, to focus first on tax reform. If he can successfully cut the corporate tax rate, he won't need tariffs. You will bring these companies back to the United States because overnight, it'll be more profitable to do business here, to expand here, to hire here.
Why would that be so difficult? You got enough Republicans in both houses. What's the difficulty?
I don't know that it is difficult. He's been president for less than a month, so I want to give him a chance. But he has a very dynamic pro-growth economic plan that he rolled out in the campaign during the election. And if he will implement it, there's no question in my mind that it will begin the economy's revival. And a growing economy and more revenues gives you both the time and the resources to fix our other problems. It's the keystone to his success. So I think he will push very hard on the economy in an effort to enact his reform agenda. Immigration will probably be second, but he has every intention of renegotiating NAFTA and renegotiating the other big international trade deals to get a better deal for the American people.
We started off the show tonight by talking about the Mount Rushmore of conservatives. Richard Nixon is a symbol. So is it too drafty in here, or can we see the homage to Richard Nixon?
Well, if everybody in the place puts up $10, I'll take my shirt off. No, there's a time and place for this, but let me address it. It's true. I have a tattoo of Richard Nixon's face on my back. It's about the size of a grapefruit, and it's equidistant between my shoulders. Now, there's several reasons why I have this. One, I was very drunk when I got it. Two, It really pisses liberals off. Three, very few people know a guy with a in the front and the back. But believe it or not, it is not a political statement. It's not ideological. It's not political at all. What it is a daily reminder for me that in life, when things don't go your way, when you get knocked down, when you're defeated, when something you were really counting on doesn't come through, when you're ready to give up and throw in the towel, that's when you have an obligation to get up off the mat and get back in the fight. That's the story of Nixon. It's a story of resilience. It's a story of indestructibility. It's a story of never quitting. Nixon's greatest quote, "A man is not finished when he is defeated. He's only finished when he quits." And that's what I believe. Thank you, Dom. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, the great Roger Stone. We have to get another book from him in the summertime where we can get a full look at the tattoo.
Done.
I don't know if I can use that dick line on the front and back tomorrow, but I'm going to replay a lot on the show tomorrow of Roger Stone tonight. Thanks, everyone, for coming out to a great theater, a great experience tonight. Thanks for joining us, as always, and I hope that you enjoy the book as much as I did. Thanks, folks.
Well done. That's very good. Good.